Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Last night, as I mentioned earlier, I was in the audience at Town Hall for New Yorker magazine editor and host of the New Yorker Radio Hour, David Remnick's interview of former FBI Director James Comey. As you know, Comey is making the rounds for his book called A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership. Parts of it will be a special edition of the New Yorker Radio Hour this weekend, that is parts of their interview. And David is being nice enough to come on with us now with some excerpts and impressions. Hi, David. Thanks so much.
Good morning, Brian.
And you did a great job with Comey last night. Besides all the issues, you're both really good conversationalists. Did you enjoy talking to him?
I'll be honest with you. You're very kind. I was a little bit wary because you're absolutely right. He's on book tour. And, you know what happens on book tour. People start, telling their best stories 15 times. And I sensed watching him with Jake Tapper in the afternoon that he had shot his bolt and maybe he was going to be very cautious when he got to Town Hall last night. So I was concerned because when you know that you have 75 minutes on stage with somebody, you can, if within 5 or 10 minutes you realize that person hasn't come to play, that's an awful lot of time to fill with nothing. As it turned out, I was really pleased to see that it might have been the presence of the audience. I don't know what the reason was, but I thought he was much more frank and self-searching than I had been concerned about.
Well, I picked out a few excerpts that I found interesting from your interview last night, some of them on the news, some of them not so much. Here's the Giuliani section, and as a little bit of background, with the fire hose of news that's taking place 24/7 these days, there was the surreal situation of the Giuliani story that he's joining Trump's legal team breaking just before the interview, and you incorporated it. So here's the 1 minute and 10 second question and answer regarding Giuliani.
One of the major figures early in the book, or sort of partway through the book, is Rudolph Giuliani, with whom you worked. Mm-hmm. You describe him as someone who's skilled, who's smart, a tough prosecutor, someone you had admired on one level, but you also said that the worst place to be, or you were quoting somebody else, I think, the worst place to be was between Rudolph Giuliani and a microphone. That he's described, not to mince words here, and it's my word, not yours, but as an egomaniac. Now, tonight comes the news that Rudolph Giuliani is going to join Donald Trump's legal team. What do you make of that?
I don't know what to make of it. There's no doubt that Rudy Giuliani is a very smart, as I said, you're right, that's how I described it, smart and skilled attorney. And I don't know what the attorney-client dynamic is like around the president. And so it may be he'll be successful in areas where others weren't, or maybe it'll precipitate a clash. I just don't know.
David, that was probably the first time that most of the people in the audience had heard the news about Giuliani joining Trump's legal team regarding Mueller. Why do you think they laughed at the question?
Well, because I think first of all, they're reacting to Comey's obvious dislike, disdain for Giuliani. There's just no question about it. And he expressed that facially as well as in his very, decorously cautious language.
I guess that was it.
Yeah.
So I
have to say this morning I was going, because there's nothing like wasting time on YouTube, I ran across a YouTube of Donald Trump doing a bit with Rudolph Giuliani dressed in kind of drag. Do you remember this?
Sure. But that was for a comedy show.
Yeah, it takes on a special resonance now. It's really quite something.
I guess.
Yeah, it's life is just too absurd these days.
So there was that clip. You also asked about whether Comey went public with his criticism of Hillary Clinton in 2016, even though he had decided not to indict her, because he thought anti-Clinton FBI staffers were going to leak stuff to Giuliani, who was with the Trump campaign, and it would go public. Here's that.
There was an issue, and I don't know. I mean, you stated it like a fact. I don't know whether people inside the FBI New York were giving information to Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, I know. I mean, they were leaking to the press. I mean, we know.
Okay. Well, I don't know. But I was sufficiently concerned about it that I ordered an investigation that wasn't completed by the time I was fired to find out whether there were people having unauthorized contact with the press. But that's not why I made the decision.
You obviously didn't buy that shrug about not knowing anything about that.
Yeah, I don't buy it. I don't think necessarily that's why he did what he did, but clearly it was a factor. There were elements in the New York office of the FBI who were very well connected to Rudolph Giuliani, who couldn't stand Clinton. And, you know, remember, when you're the director of the FBI, you're not some sort of moral figure or religious figure or some such. You are a politician, too. You're not just a law enforcement. And you have political concerns to deal with and political problems to deal with. And one of them was that you had, for want of a better word, renegade voices who had no compunction about, you know, dropping a dime on what was going on.
Yeah. Comey kept defending the culture of the FBI to you as professional and non-political. But we've seen evidence of a pro-Trump faction, like with those stories in that clip, and anti-Trump factions, like Lisa Page and Peter Strzok, who got fired by Mueller for anti-Trump texts. And Comey did not give us a sense last night. He didn't seem interested in going there in response to your question.
Comey is well aware historically of the, let's just say, the fallen history of the FBI and the CIA and all the rest. When Comey became
Martin Luther King, COINTELPRO, all of that.
Not only that, but Comey himself, no matter what you may think of his politics, and he has politics, no one is absent politics, that Comey distributed among the leadership of the FBI J. Edgar Hoover's order to exact surveillance on Martin Luther King with the object of trying to destroy him. And he did this with moral purpose, was saying, look, this is the kind of awful thing that happened in the past in the FBI.
But was it him, or was it
a complicated figure?
Was it him or was it you who said that all changed after the post-Watergate reforms?
That was him.
And I guess we don't know the full extent of the truth or incompleteness of that if there are these various factions on various sides that have leaked into public view a little bit in the last couple of years. Here's another excerpt from your Comey interview that I found actually maybe the most fascinating stretch, and I'm going to devote our longest clip to it because I thought it was important, and no one else that I've heard, and I haven't heard every interview that Comey's done all week, but no one else I've heard has asked him to talk about this part of the book. This is about a conversation he had as FBI director with President Obama about language pertaining to racial justice, including the term mass incarceration. This is 3 minutes and worth it.
The president invited me to come to the Oval Office to talk about law enforcement and race, and I had been expressing concern about dramatic increases in homicides of African-American men in major cities all over the country. And I was worried nobody was going to talk about that. And he asked me to come, and we had a really interesting conversation about that. And it started with him sharing with me words that I had used that struck him. And one was weed and seed. I talked about a program that I thought you can't arrest your way to a healthy neighborhood. That if you have to arrest people, you do it only so you can fill the space with something healthy to make the neighborhood grow in a better way. But he said, look, I want you to think about how that term would strike the ears of an African American. You're speaking about people you're arresting as weeds. And I said to him, you know, Mr. President, I actually had not thought about it that way. It's a program that's been worked by the Justice Department through different administrations, Democrat and Republican, but I hadn't thought about it that way. And then he talked some also about the trade-off between...
Did you think he was right?
I think he was right. That had I thought about it better, I'd have either not used the term or explained what I meant. And so I think his perspective was really useful. And so we were doing a back and forth, and I said, Mr. President, there's a term that you use, I just want you to know, strikes law enforcement's ears, especially those of us who spent so much of our lives trying to rescue predominantly black communities. And I did a lot of that work in Richmond, and it's mass incarceration. And I said, the reason that sounds an odd note in our ears is that it connotes an intentionality, almost a Korematsu type intentionality. And I agree with your list, there's a list of tragedies associated with the huge number, especially of men of color, black men in particular, in jail. But there's nothing mass about it in that sense. I mean, everybody was charged individually, represented individually, appeared in front of a judge, contested guilt or pled guilty, had an opportunity for appeal.
Would you say their level of representation? I mean, most of them plea. 90% of them are in plea situations. Their representation is horrendous for the most part, poor African-American men.
And well, that's
isn't
fair.
That a systemic problem?
It is, but I think you can talk about those systemic problems in a thoughtful way without, and this is how I told him the mass incarceration term, without making it sound like there was an intentionality where law enforcement decided we're going to round up huge numbers of black men and put them behind bars. There's no doubt it's a tragedy, but I said, I just want to let you know that's a term that at least to law enforcement's ears strikes a discordant note. And then we went on and talked about a bunch of other things. We had a great back and forth. But
I assume you didn't convince him.
Maybe I did secretly, but he did not say.
I think it's a secret then.
It's still a secret. Yeah.
So,
but it's interesting. After that, I tried to watch his public remarks, and it could be I'm just projecting, that I saw it far less frequently than I had before, and I don't know whether that's because I was useful to him or not.
James Comey, former FBI director, with New Yorker magazine editor David Remnick. We'll keep playing excerpts from their town hall interview last night. But David, I'm so glad you brought that out. I mean,
it's a strange moment, isn't it? Because it shows him to be such, well, there is the nature of his conservatism. In other words, when I say that everybody has politics, I'm not suggesting for a second that he's pro-Trump or he's pro this or that, but there is the nature of his conservatism from a law enforcement point of view. In fact, mass incarceration is a widely accepted, not only term, but notion, and it's reached into even conservative areas now. The very idea that Barack Obama has changed his mind on this is a fantasy. Far from it. I think it's widely accepted that this country has the level of incarceration that it does. It's more people in jail than it has in the military. And you know, the number of people incarcerated is the size of a large American city at this point. And it didn't happen by accident. It happened because of sentencing guidelines. It happened because of all kinds of laws instituted by government. It's how we arrange ourselves, and it's uniquely focused on people of color, particularly African-American men, who get busted for, arrested, and convicted and sentenced at very, very different rates from their white brothers and sisters. It's a national outrage, widely recognized at this point. This is not some narrow focus of radical academia.
So
but
on
he
that,
he takes it very personally.
On that language, mass incarceration and weed and seed, quote unquote, and his relationship to those terms to this day, no matter if we think from this book tour that Comey is a man of integrity, trying to be true to the truth as he sees it, especially with respect to Donald Trump, he might not be all that woke on race.
He's certainly not woke on mass incarceration, let's put it that way.
We're going to take a break, and we'll continue with David Remnick and more excerpts from his James Comey interview at Town Hall last night. We can take a few phone calls for David if you want to ask him anything, or how many James Comey interviews have you consumed this week, listeners? Anything you want to react to from any of them, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You realize that Comey did Jake Tapper live at 4 o'clock, did that with you on stage live at 7 o'clock to 8:30, and then was on Rachel Maddow on MSNBC at 9 o'clock?
I suspect he might have had a good long tall drink after Rachel Maddow. You know, he had a pretty long day. But you know, look, let's remember this. He is publishing a book that got an advance of $2 million.
Yeah.
They want to sell books. And he's gotten a lot of criticism, not just from the President of the United States, but from inside the FBI for publishing at just the moment that this investigation is going on. I have no problem with it, but it certainly there's been criticism of him.
Do you happen to know if he did Fox? I actually don't know. Or if he wound up avoiding Fox?
It might be one and the same thing. I don't think he has done Fox, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
More with David Remnick in a minute.
Hi, it's Chris Thiele. This Weekend Live from here is back at the fabulous Town Hall in New York City. We have some amazing guests joining us, including Sufjan Stevens and U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith. And I'll have a brand new song of the week. Hope you'll join us right here for all this and more this weekend.
Tickets are still available for tomorrow's show at wnyc.org/events. Can't be there in person? Listen live on the radio at 6 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
WNYC supporters include Rutgers University Continuing Studies, your lifelong learning partner, offering online opportunities for professional development and for fully online degrees. More information at lifelonglearning.rutgers.edu. Mohonk Mountain House, presenting Memorial Day weekend, May 25th through 28th, featuring archery and tomahawk throwing, campfire with s'mores, live music, and more. Mohonk.com.
In the 1960s, radical change came to American poetry.
What would happen if one woman told the truth about her life?
The world would split open.
I'm Meryl Streep. Join me for A Change of World, Poetry and the Women's Movement. We'll hear how the women's movement changed poetry and how women poets worked together to change the culture.
Tonight at 9 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New Yorker magazine editor David Remnick, also host of the New Yorker Radio Hour, produced here at WNYC or by WNYC, and there'll be a special New Yorker Radio Hour with extended excerpts, obviously, from the David Remnick, James Comey interview last night at Town Hall, but David is good enough to come on with us this morning with a few selected excerpts. David, there's some kind of related breaking news just now. The Washington Post just put this up on their site a few minutes ago. It says the Democratic National Committee alleges that top Trump campaign officials conspired with the Russian government and its military spy agency to hurt Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton and tilt the election to Donald Trump by hacking the computer networks of the Democratic Party and disseminating stolen material found there. The multimillion-dollar lawsuit was filed in federal district court in Manhattan. And this article says the lawsuit echoes a similar legal tactic that the Democratic Party used during the Watergate scandal. In 1972, the DNC filed suit against former President Richard Nixon's reelection committee seeking $1 million in damages for the break-in at Democratic headquarters in the Watergate building. And this is so fascinating to me because
Incredible.
We now have a private civil lawsuit alleging what the Mueller investigation is investigating and hasn't come to a conclusion yet, which is there was collusion.
It's incredible. I mean, the hits keep coming, don't they? I just should say, by the way, if you want to listen to the entire interview, it's if you go on the New Yorker homepage, the practically uncut interview is already up, and the New Yorker Radio Hour will do one that fits into its hour long format. I don't know what to say, Brian. I think you and your listeners and certainly we at the New Yorker live our lives in this bizarre way, in a way that it's exacerbated obviously by social media and the speed to which we can post news, whether it's the Washington Post, the New Yorker, or us, or it jangles your life. People are unnerved by not only the speed of the news and the sense of chaos, but the way that it derails us from thinking clearly about really serious social problems that we face and foreign policy questions that we face, but everything seems to be in a state of chaos. I thought what was striking last night with James Comey, no matter what you feel about him, this was not a chaotic mind. And what I don't know how you felt about it sitting in the audience, and maybe you had a better view of it in a certain way, but I found that this guy is deeply, deeply ripped up emotionally, that he knows that some enormous proportion of the country, whether because you're a Hillary supporter or you resent the investigations into Trump, hates him. And he feels it very acutely, and he has rational explanations for his thinking in real time. But he knows that those decisions have affected history in abysmal ways.
So to that point, so much has been made of Comey's criticisms of Trump's character in the book, that he's like a mafia don, he's untethered to the truth, etc. He said a chillingly psychological thing to you about him last night. Let me play that.
I've never seen the man laugh. And the reason that's important to me is, first of all, it's noticeable in an adult. And I think laughter is a tell that someone has a balance of confidence and humility. Because it takes a certain amount of confidence as a leader to risk yourself by laughing. Because when I laugh at something you say, I've just made an admission that you said something funny, and I've also risked myself by looking a little silly.
Right.
And so really insecure people don't want to do that, and never having seen the person laugh just struck me.
David, was that observation in the book, or is that something that he just said last night?
It's in passing in the book, but you know who else mentioned this? Is somebody who was an expert in laughter.
Yeah.
I interviewed Al Franken for the New Yorker Radio Hour, and he too pointed out this phenomenal characteristic of Trump, that he doesn't laugh. There's pain smiles sometimes, but the generosity that's involved in laughter is utterly absent from Donald Trump. So that's a very odd combination of judges, isn't it? James Comey and Al Franken.
Yeah, and I was checking my memory last night after hearing that, and the only times I could remember hearing him laugh, or almost laugh, it was because he was amused at things he himself had said. Like on the Access Hollywood tape itself, he doesn't laugh per se. I actually went back and watched this morning to check my memory, because I thought, oh, doesn't he laugh during that? They're cracking each other up, which is, you know, gross. But so it turns out that he's cracking up Billy Bush with his self-amused boasts. When you're a star, you can do anything. And when he says the P word, it's a punchline for him. And, you know, Billy Bush is not just LOL, but R-O-F-L. So
yeah, but it's Billy Bush that's doing the laughing.
That's right. That's my, that's my point.
Kissing away.
That's right. So his relationship to laughter is even weirder than Comey said, which is hard to achieve.
Well, I think by now we understand the colossal, colossal, unimaginable neediness of this guy for approbation and praise and attention all the time. And it's just, you know, remember, as you do, Brian, this guy, Donald Trump, was a figure that we didn't have to take all that seriously, unless you happen to be in the construction business and getting screwed over in a business deal. He was somebody who was on the cover of Spy magazine or in Page Six. He was a kind of, you know, as I say, a figure on the New York jokosphere. Now he's a figure that's going to be at the negotiating table with the North Korean dictator. Now he's a figure who's putting forth the immigration policies that he is and making racist statements in the name of the United States of America as its commander-in-chief. It's a degrading, bewildering, maddening spectacle. And I'm afraid that people who in the past have said character is really a meaningless consideration when you're thinking about who to elect, this is just desserts.
Kathleen in Jersey City, you're on WNYC with David Remnick from The New Yorker. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, thank you. Love you both. My suspicion is that or do you think that Comey more or less started this investigation into Hillary's emails because his motive was, okay, this subtle motive is, this is the boy's network, and okay, you're a woman, and we want to just stab you. We just want to give you this so you can see, like, you're a woman and we're the men, and kind of like a empowering belittling gesture. What do you think?
I think, Kathleen, with real respect, I don't think that's the case. I think that even the Clinton people in their most honest moments know that her use or abuse of email was a profound mistake, and that it was warranted to look into. There's just no getting around that. Now, with the nature of the investigation, how it was carried out, the way announcements were made, and how they were timed in terms of the election, and then the Wiener business, that is another matter. But I don't think that James Comey and the Department of Justice initiated an investigation because she was a woman. I mean, and with full knowledge of the nature and depth of the role that sexism played in this campaign, I don't think that it's on this score.
So here we are,
you may count me naive, but I respectfully disagree on that one.
Here we are, two guys having this conversation, but there's probably another conversation to be had about implicit bias and some of the ways that Hillary Clinton was perceived and treated through the investigation. But we've talked about that in the past on the show, and we'll have to leave that further for a later date. But Diana in Harlem, you're on WNYC with David Remnick. Hi, Diana.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you so much. I'm so excited to talk to both of you. David, I actually came up to you at the end of town hall last night. I'm an e-discovery attorney. And something that I don't think has been explored enough is all the accounts and all the reporting of what the FBI did to look into the electronically stored information on Wiener's laptop in October suggests that they are either criminally negligently behind the curve on e-discovery technology, or there is something fishy going on.
What about the timing, David? Any thought?
Well, the tragedy of the timing is that Comey was told by his staff that it would take a long time to look in these thousands of emails. In fact, it only took several days. It could have been accomplished quietly, and they would have found, as they did, that it was these emails were completely duplicative. They revealed nothing new, certainly nothing suggesting reopening a criminal investigation. So, what happened on October 28th? Comey sends a letter to Congress saying that he has to look into this, in effect, reopening an investigation. The letter, everybody knew, would have to leak because the Republicans in Congress, it took them, you know, a matter of minutes to leak this. So as Nate Silver from the polling website 538 has made quite clear, the effect of this announcement on October 28th, just 11 days before the election, really had an enormous effect. And Hillary Clinton has every right to suggest that this was the decisive factor that did her in at the end. You can argue that she about her campaign and where she went and where she didn't go and sense of purpose as a campaigner, because after all, it's Hillary Clinton that raised the question, why aren't I ahead by 20 points?
Yeah. So further to that point, and Diana, thank you for your call. Further to your point, here's another thing that I'm really glad you asked last night, David. While he went public with the reopening of the Clinton investigation there on October 28th, the FBI was not revealing and maybe even concealing what it had on the Trump campaign and Russia by then. We're going to play a two-minute clip. And again, this is relatively long for a soundbite, but worth it. Here's your pointed question and Comey's response.
On October 31st, 2016, The New York Times, a metropolitan newspaper of some regard, published a story headlined, Investigating Donald Trump, FBI sees no clear link to Russia. And that story, sourcing FBI sources, said, quote, law enforcement officials say that none of the investigations so far have found any conclusive or direct link between Mr. Trump and the Russian government. And even the hacking into Democratic emails, FBI and intelligence officials now believe, was aimed at disrupting the presidential election rather than electing Mr. Trump, unquote. FBI sources also said that no evidence has emerged that would link him or anyone else in his business or political circle directly to Russia's election operations. The Times quoted an FBI official saying, it isn't about the election, it's about a threat to democracy. In fact, didn't the FBI already know about George Papadopoulos' involvement with the Russians? The intelligence agencies knew that the Russians were engaged in efforts to meet with members of the Trump campaign and do damage to the Clinton campaign. CIA Director Brennan, at that point, strongly believed that the Russians were supporting the Trump candidacy in many ways. Why would the FBI push that story on the New York Times a week before the election?
Yeah, that's a hard one to answer. I don't know who the FBI is in this context. The FBI didn't, as to my knowledge, push any such story. By that point, we had concluded that there was an ongoing effort, that it had three goals: to dirty up the American democracy, to hurt Hillary Clinton, and to help elect Donald Trump. And so I don't know who was talking to the New York Times, but that's my reaction to
it. You're saying that the FBI sources, or the Times' FBI sources on that story a week before the election were wrong.
I don't want to react to all of that because I'm being careful to abide my earlier rule where I'm not going to talk about details of the investigation, but at least with respect to the bit about what the goals of the Russian effort were, it's just wrong. And that's the challenge of an organization of 38,000 people. I don't know who the FBI is in this context.
David, that was one of the moments in the interview where the question was better than the answer.
Well, I don't for a minute suggest that somehow James Comey himself was the source here and he's lying. I'm not suggesting that at all. But the New York Times reporters are competent enough and intelligent enough that they're not talking to the guy who's sweeping the floor either. So that was a story. And remember, the New York Times has not just the influence on the readers who read the New York Times, a couple million or whatever it might be, it also helps dictate what so many other news outlets publish and broadcast. And so for a story to come out like that on that late in the game is damaging. And Comey has no real good explanation for it.
Yeah, he certainly did not. We just have a minute left. Comey said that thing to you that he also said on ABC about preferring that even though he thinks Trump is a threat to the rule of law, he thinks it's better for the country if Trump is not impeached. Here's that.
As odd as it may sound, I kind of hope that he isn't impeached and removed from office because of what it will do to us. It will lock in our dysfunction and our divide when what we need is a moment of clarity and inflection in this country. And that would postpone it.
So do you have an opinion about that? I mean, I could see it either way, honestly. Either what Comey said for the reasons he said it, or if Trump really obstructed justice or other things that may come out, it's important to show that the justice system is responsive to that and that politics doesn't overtake that. Do you have an opinion?
I do. I look, there's no question that any impeachment drama, whether it's in the 19th century or whether it's the impending one on Nixon or what happened to Bill Clinton, that is not a happy moment for a country. That is a divisive, dramatic, painful episode that has real ramifications that go on not just for a couple of weeks in a news cycle, but probably have lasting effects for years. And I think that's what he's trying to get at, that you if you can avoid such a pain. But if he is potentially guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors, the political system has to do its work. But that's all ahead of us, Brian. I think, you know, there's a lot of journalistic work to be done, but even more so, there's quite clearly, as we're seeing, more investigative work to be done by Mueller and the courts. So we will see.
So we played some excerpts from your interview. Tell our listeners how they can hear the rest.
They can hear it by right now going on the New Yorker's website and hearing the full and unexpurgated interview in excess of an hour. I think it's an hour and 15 minutes. then certainly on WNYC tomorrow morning on the New Yorker Radio Hour at 10, and again repeated on Sunday evening. They'll be able to hear it in its hour-long format. So it's and I thank you, Brian, as always, for both having me on and giving such full play to this session. It's one in it. He did make news, and one of the things he said is, as we were closing out, I said, you know, you're hesitant to say, even through all of this, and he's incredibly critical of Trump, as you know, wouldn't you say that life would be a little bit better if Hillary Clinton would be president, for whatever faults you may see in her? And he had avoided answering this question over and over again, I had seen, but last night he said yes, things would be better with Hillary Clinton, for having to do with reasons of living within the law and much else.
Thanks for doing this one-on-one with us. Thank you so much.
Always, Brian. Be well.